Good afternoon, and welcome to the 15th Annual Boston Book Festival. My name is Danielle Castelli, and I am a member of the BBF board. I support the BBF quite simply because I love books. The magic of the Boston Book Festival has captivated me since the festival's first year back in 2009, when I happened upon a session with Chris Van Allsburg, the author of Jumanji and the Polar Express. The festival has continued to celebrate and promote reading in this city with amazing author programming free to the public. We rely on donations, large and small, to do that. If you believe in the importance of reading and are enjoying yourself here today, please consider joining me as a supporter of the BBF. I encourage you to donate in any amount online or become a member by visiting our member table at the BBF booth. You'll receive some great swag as a thank you. And now I am pleased to introduce Sarah Farazan, who will be moderating our YA keynote with Chloe Gong. Welcome, Sarah and Chloe.
Wow, thanks. Wow. Wow. What a great crowd, Chloe. Only you could draw this kind of awesome, vivacious crowd.
Charming.
Yeah, and charming, yes. And full of witty, absorbing wit. We have inside jokes now. That's fun. Okay, so before we begin, few logistics. So there's going to be a Q&A because I know you guys have a lot of questions for Chloe. While it is an inclusive event, we would hope that if there is a younger person of a young adult variety or kid variety, that they please be allowed to go at the front of the line just because I'm biased. I like kids.
You said adults can wait longer.
Yes.
Yeah. Stand on your feet.
Yeah, you'll be okay. But just that there will be a time where I say, okay, it's time for Q&A. Please line up behind this microphone in an orderly fashion. Another thing that will be in an orderly fashion is the signing line for Chloe. There are books for sale in the back. And if you have a book, that's okay. There will be a line for you. But please make sure that Chloe gets off stage, is settled in a safe signing area before getting up. Is that y'all cool with that? Okay.
Yeah, don't tackle me.
Yeah. So I'm Sarah Farazan. I'm a local young adult and middle grade author. I'm going to introduce Chloe with her very prestigious bio, and then we are going to give her a very rip-roaring Boston welcome, accent or no. I've just talked to her about Havid Yad. She was not impressed, but that's okay. We have things to do. So, Chloe, I'm going to read your very impressive bio.
Thank you.
Are you ready for it? Okay. And then after it, you have to be like, that is the most impressive bio. What an impressive person. I will ask her questions, Q&A. We're all good? Okay. Chloe Gong is the number one, New York Times bestselling author of the critically acclaimed Secret Shanghai novels, as well as the Flesh and False Gods trilogy. Her books have been published in over 20 countries and have been featured in the New York Times, People, Forbes, and more. I also saw you on the Drew Barrymore show. Good job. That was great.
Thank you.
No big. She is a recent graduate of the University of Pennsylvania, where she double majored in English and International Relations. Born in Shanghai and raised in Auckland, New Zealand, Chloe is now located in New York City pretending to be a real adult, aren't we all? Let's please give a great Boston welcome to Chloe Gong.
Wow. Thank you.
So, Chloe, congratulations.
You're very welcome.
Oh, good. See, we did it.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Congrats on Foul Heart Huntsman.
Thank
Huntsman.
You.
How many of you have read the book? Okay. Whoa. But a lot of you are going to start today.
It's a thick book. Even if you started like when it came out, I would understand.
Yes.
They're only on like chapter 10.
But we will keep the discussion as spoiler-free as possible. Yes. Unless one of you is like, no, that's when blah, blah happened. Don't do that. Because don't be that person. Mm-hmm. So, Chloe, if there is someone who is new to this particular series, mm-hmm. how would you explain it to them?
Oh.
Not the whole thing, but
okay.
What can they have in store? Mm-hmm. For?
Well, I have my official, like, quick pitch, and then I have my, like, fun quick pitch. So my official quick pitch is that Foul Heart Huntsman is the second book and the conclusion to the Foul Lady Fortune duology. It follows Rosalind, who is a assassin in 1930s Shanghai, when her spy partner Orion gets brainwashed and kidnapped. And she goes on a national tour to get him back, essentially, because, you know, there are a lot of strange science things happening in the city. It's the Japanese Empire is about to invade. Things aren't looking so good. That is a very long way of saying, if you really, really squint at Foul Heart Huntsman, it is Captain America and Bucky fanfiction. Not officially sanctioned, okay? But the vibes are there. And if Marvel asks, I never said this. Yeah.
So nobody posts that.
Yeah.
But that's true. Okay, well, now we know. Yeah. So this is the finale.
It is.
How does it feel to end a series? And what is, like, how does that feel? And are you going to revisit them ever again or this universe?
No. Well, you know, as Justin Bieber once said,
never say never.
Yeah. Never say never. Yeah. I do think right now this is definitely the finale.
Okay.
I always think of, you know, series needs to end. Like, there needs to be a conclusion. Characters need to be able to have their ending when they have learned the things that you set out to learn with them. So as far as this main cast of characters go, you know, they learned their lessons, they had their angst, had their pain, suffered, and suffering ends here. That being said, I don't know if there might be another story that calls to me in the future, so I never will rule it out entirely, but at least for now, you know, it is very bittersweet, but in the same way as, like, sending your kid off to college, you know? You're saying goodbye so that they can go off and do nice things for themselves. You've put them through the ringer enough.
But they can always move back home if things are tough.
If the economy crashes.
Hey, I've been there. I graduated 2008. You guys
don't
know. Yeah.
Damn.
Good times.
Yeah.
I want to be a writer. Okay. is there a character in this series that you started writing with and you had a direction for them, but over the course of the books they surprised you in some way? They were speaking to you in a way that you hadn't set out. Like, was there a character that did that for you?
Absolutely. I mean, I am a very big plotter, so normally I will go in deciding this character starts the series believing these things and they will end the series believing this set of different things. Most of the main characters will behave because I have planned it out, like, step by step. It is usually the kind of, like, side main characters that will completely shock me. So there's a character in Hera Phoebe. She's one of my favorites. Yeah. She's first described as, like, a puff of a pink cloud because her skirts are, like, you know, poof. She was so much fun to write in this book because for so much of book one, she is hiding who she really is. And I'm trying to keep it spoiler-free. Yeah. I'm trying not to spoil
things. Listen, they're spies.
Yeah.
People have different aliases.
And identities.
Yes.
You know, things aren't always what
betrayal,
you think.
Espionage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So at the end of Foul Lady Fortune, you learn that Phoebe is a certain someone. And in Foul Heart Huntsman, we actually get to explore that, figure out how she was, you know, led into that. And I just really love writing, like, teenage girl characters who are allowed to be, like, a fluff ball of, like, pretty pink dresses and also, like, very dangerous.
Yeah.
You know? It's so much fun. And there were some moments where she was like, I want to kill some people. And I was like, okay. Go on.
It was great. Did you read a lot of spy books when you were a kid, or did you watch a lot of spy media, or?
I was a big Nancy Drew girly.
Okay.
So.
Have you heard of her? Do you guys? Okay.
They're not that young.
I'm just checking. I don't know. I know the CW had a show.
That's true. They did reboot Nancy Drew into, like, a dark, like, a Riverdale treatment.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah. I guess Nancy Drew isn't really spies per se, but I really loved mystery novels growing up. And I think it kind of shows in either I'm writing something that's kind of like, we need to figure out who the killer is, or we need to figure out why things are happening.
Mm-hmm.
So big, big Nancy Drew girly. I also was reading, like, the Hardy Boys, like, all of those things. C-dramas are also always about spies.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
Especially if it's in the 30s.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, they were real spies during that time.
Yeah, yeah.
So, big fan of spy media.
Yeah. And because it is historical fiction, even though there's fantastical elements in sci-fi, I'm sure you did a lot of research on 1932 for mm-hmm. this book in particular. Mm-hmm. Were there any facts or anything that was interesting that you thought about putting in the book, but mm-hmm. you're like, you know what, they don't actually need to know, the reader doesn't need to know this fun fact about 1932?
I mean, so many. Yeah. There are all of these like small things that I will try to include, mm-hmm. and then I'll think, actually, no one is going to find that interesting except for me. If it is genuinely interesting, I will change things about the story mm-hmm. to make it work. Mm-hmm. Or at the very least, like, I will make sure it has a place and it's sure. justified in the narrative. But otherwise, it's, you know, I'm not picky. I get rid of the darlings. I will, you know, snip
things out.
That's good.
That means you're, yeah. Yeah, you're writing.
I'm writing.
You like it, huh? Yeah, you're good at it. Good job. Yeah. Okay. You've been on tour this fall to promote this book. Mm-hmm. And Rosalind has also been on tour yes. in a portion of this book. Mm-hmm. She has a handler. Mm. I was wondering which of the characters would you want to be your handler during tour?
Oh my God, none of them.
Okay.
They're all chaotic beings. Well, I did make this joke throughout tour. Every tour stop, I was like pitching the book first. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Rosalind is also on national tour, so I'm cosplaying her in more ways than my trauma. And that always got, you know.
You didn't laugh loud.
No. Here's the thing. I also got nervous laughs on tour. They were like, are we allowed to laugh at that? Like, is that okay? So.
So none of the characters would be able to handle.
Well, if you really think about it, they would all abandon handling me for their own missions.
Yeah.
So I can't hold it against them mm-hmm. either way. Maybe I'd have like Elisa handle me.
She'd be great.
Yeah. I mean,
she would criticize your driving,
oh, yeah.
her driving, someone else's driving.
She would probably crash us into a tree and then be like, well, did you die?
So. Be like, I got you here.
Yeah.
I got you to Orlando to do this book event. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Well, that's something to think about if she were real. Okay.
If
there's another thing you do really well, that is use humor.
Oh, thanks.
Oh, no problem.
I'm a regular comedian.
You do it in which, like, Rosalind will get, again, not to spoil, but there's fight scenes. Rosalind will get, like, a knife to the shoulder, or, like, there's a car chase, mm-hmm. or something's going on. And then they're, like, making fun of each other,
yep.
or being like, that's unhelpful right now. Like, there are all these kind of jokes peppered out throughout these, like, very tense action-packed scenes.
Uh-huh.
But the jokes never puncture the scene. Like, they don't.
Oh, thank you.
It keeps it going, like, mm-hmm. with pacing. How do you decide what's funny? And how do you utilize humor without it taking away from the action of the scene?
Mm-hmm. I am that annoying person where if I'm editing, I'm reading it out loud.
Mm.
And I also edit and write in public. So you can imagine that like people sitting next to me at cafes are like getting an audiobook of my book like way in advance.
The bonus.
Of release. Yeah. Well, I don't know. Like the businessman trying to do his like PowerPoint slides probably is pretty annoyed at me going, and then she went like this. Like I'm mumbling too. I'm not actually speaking it out loud. I just sound vaguely possessed.
That's better than what the businessman is saying, where he's like, 44 share, I like it. Let's go, Barry, or whatever. You know? I'd rather
that is very true. That's very true. Yeah, so I'm a big, like, I'll read everything out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And my primary test is, do I find it funny? Because chances are, like, I mean, I don't know. I don't think my humor is that different to other people. If I'm like, hee-hee, you know, I'm like, other people are probably having a little hee-hee moment as well.
Sure. But there's a difference between hee-hee and, like, a guffaw.
Oh, you know? Well, I mean, I don't know if anyone ever, like, laughs out loud at my books.
Okay. There's no time for guffaws.
Yeah, you kind of, like, you have a funny line. They're like, oh, someone's bleeding out, you know? So I like the little hee-hee moments.
Okay.
I think I was raised in, like, the era of YA where, like, every love interest was, like, the most sarcastic person known to mankind. You know, I was raised by Jace Herondale.
Okay.
So I really think that, like, my approach to, like, the peppering humor is always the, like, hee-hee moments.
Okay.
Yeah.
So hee-hee.
Yeah. Like lowercase hee-hee.
Okay. Got it. But not like a huh.
No, not like a caps lock ha-ha.
No, that's too much.
Yeah. Lowercase hee-hee.
Nobody in the Foul Heart Huntsman has time for ha-ha.
No.
Like, we have things to do.
Exactly.
There are a lot of reunions in this novel.
Mm-hmm.
Which I won't say who, because you didn't read it yet. Shame on you. And a lot of characters that are kind of putting all their cards on the table and are being honest for the first time in a lot of ways. What goes into writing a satisfying reunion scene?
Oh, well, I think for a reunion to be satisfying, they have to be apart for long enough to justify it. And, you know, I get this question a lot, being like, Chloe, why did you leave, like, the ending of this ambiguous? Chloe, why didn't you just tell us? Chloe, why didn't they join each other, like, a few years ago? And I'm like, well, did you want the reunion scene or not? Because that's what causes the emotional resonance of two characters who, for whatever reason, have needed to justify being apart, despite the fact that, like, you know, whether it be family or, like, friends or, like, lovers, you need some reason that you have been apart, and then coming together makes it so much more satisfying. So some of these reunion scenes have been a long time coming, like years in the timeline of the books, but also years for me.
Right.
Because I have been plotting it since like my previous duology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always say you can read the previous duology on its own, you can read the Foul Lady Fortune duology on its own, but there's a special little treat for the readers who have gone through all of them. And the treat is the emotional resonance of those reunions.
Yeah, getting these characters who have gone through a lot to finally be like, can we take a break? Or I really like you. Okay, yeah, cool.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're like, can I have one hug? Just one.
I mean, I got stabbed.
Yeah.
I got things coming at me. Yeah.
A lot of bombardment. Yeah, a lot of happening.
My favorite romantic pairing in Foul Heart Huntsman, and you can say I'm wrong, and that's okay because it's your book, is Oliver and Celia.
Oh, that's very valid. Valid opinion.
Okay, cool.
Yeah,
not the right one, but it's valid. And my favorite duo, who are not romantic but work together, is Rosalind and Alyssa. And do you have a favorite pairing, and were there pairings that you were more excited to write about than those that you were like, I can't get to you right now. I'm not in the right mindset for that.
I mean, I really try not to play favorites with my...
With your children.
With my children, but especially my romantic pairings, because I think if you... Sometimes if an author is playing favorites, you can tell.
Really?
Well, don't you ever get that feeling where you're reading a book, right, and it has multiple POVs.
Yeah.
And you get to one character's POV and you're like, oh, I don't care.
Well, I'm interested in the lesbians. The straight people, I'm not really that.
That's so valid.
Hey,
as well.
Thanks.
That's so incredible.
No,
valid.
Straight people are great too. But I could understand, like, people have their different ships and fandoms.
Yes. Sure. I really try my best to have a cast of characters where they're so integral to that main plot that if you reach their POV, there's no chance you can skip it and still understand the story the same. Because, you know, I hate it when I'm reading a multi-POV book and I'm like, I could just skip every single one of your chapters and it would not make a difference to the main storyline. So I really try not to play favorites.
Well, you gave equal time to everybody, which was really great. And to see how each of them has an arc together and apart, and you know, they're all on solid ground, and then when they come together, they're also on solid ground, which is nice.
Yes.
They don't need the other person to be a person.
They're all interwoven in some way, but standing apart. But as far as, like, you know, duos.
Yeah.
Sometimes my accent goes in and out.
I
and
love
I'm like,
it.
I'm like, am I American, actually?
Yeah. Well, you live in New York now.
I do.
So,
well, that's where I'm picking it up anyway.
Okay. Can you do a New York accent?
No, I can only do a Valley Girl accent.
Let's hear it.
Oh, my God. No way.
Yeah. Gag me with a spoon.
Oh, my God.
What?
You're kidding. That's so funny.
Let's go to the Galleria.
Okay. I really like doing Alyssa and Celia's banter.
Okay.
Because the thing about Alyssa is that she will just pop in and out. Mm-hmm. Like, she is in the chapter you least expect her to be. You know, characters will be out in the countryside, and they're going to be like, oh my God, someone's breaking into the apartment. Who could it be? And then Alyssa just tumbles in through the window. She's like, surprise! Her and any other character interacting is guaranteed to be like a hoot for me to write. Okay. But especially her and Celia, because I think Alyssa is one of those characters who is so used to being, you know, self-functional. She doesn't like to rely on people. She is so, you know, she'll make up her mind and then just do something. And then Celia is desperately trying to mother her, like chasing her around with like food, being like, please, please eat. I beg you. So they're a lot of fun.
Yeah. So you like all of them, but those ones.
Yeah. Right. I love all of them.
All right. I'm
They're
just
my
checking.
Children. I don't pick favorites.
Speaking of, if you do care about these people so much.
Wow.
How much therapy do you think Orion, Phoebe, and Oliver will need, given all the things their mother, Lady Hong, has put them through?
Mm-hmm.
And to that end, the greatest villains are... villains are ones that feel like they aren't villains.
Yes.
So tell us about Lady Hong and your crafting sort of the big bad, but how she's still so close to these very beloved characters.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you do that? Tell us so we can do it and try. But,
I mean, well, first and foremost, they need so much therapy. Like individual therapy, family therapy, couples therapy.
Yeah.
All of them.
Yep.
I like that single laugh I got over there somewhere.
Yeah. That was a ha-ha, not a hee-hee. That one, yes.
You know, I always say, like, when you give characters trauma, it ultimately serves the larger purpose of getting to explore the types of people they become because of that, and to give readers a mirror of sorts, right? So in writing Oliver, Orion, and Phoebe, I was really trying to investigate, like, what individual burdens and responsibilities do you adapt depending on your birth order? And the fact that they all have, you know, points of views in the finale of sorts, it's to understand, like, you know, one sibling may think, oh my God, my older brother has abandoned me. I can't believe I am left to pick up the family mantle. How could he be so selfish? Then you immediately switch to Oliver's point of view, and he's like, I was going to wither away if I did not do that. I could not put my beliefs aside and live under this household, et cetera, et cetera. And it really complicates humanity. It complicates how different people have their own perspectives, and they're not wrong, but they're also not completely in the right because the other person also is coming from a very different place. So I really loved getting to, I guess, like, explore perspectives that aren't even mine. Like, I am the eldest sibling, so I don't...
Yeah.
Feel me?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what it's like to be a middle sibling or the baby of the family. But
babies have it great.
They do. I really believe that. Yeah. But getting to write these characters, you almost have to put yourselves, like, in those shoes. And then you talk to readers who are like, I relate to Phoebe so much because I also feel like I have to cling my family together and things like that, right? And it's such a... I think that's writing at its most beautiful.
Mm.
You're just looking at humanity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you can see things about... Like, a reader, of course, is not a spy in 1932 Shanghai.
No.
But there are things they can relate to the humanity of
yes,
these characters.
Yes, yeah. Themes are all resonant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Shakespeare did. You like him? I heard that.
Yeah. You know, I'm a... He's all right.
Okay. I think he'll be a big deal one day. there is an amnesia storyline in this novel, which is one of my favorite things, because blank canvas, blank slate. What's it like to keep the essence of a character but have them meet everyone for the first time, especially at the end of a series in which... You know, the reader has gotten to know them, and now they're still them, but not, and they have to relearn people and things.
Yes. Oh, great question. Well, I almost think when the amnesia archetype kicks in...
We're not saying who has it.
Yeah, we're not.
But
no spoilers.
Okay.
I think when amnesia is used, it almost isn't the character. And I think that's incredibly interesting to me, because... Memories are like your personhood.
Yeah.
You are who you are because of your past, because of your history, and how that informs your present and your reactions forward. And so I think when a character is faced with complete blankness, other characters around them have to think, you know, what am I willing to give up or sacrifice to let this person stay away from the things that have hurt them? But at the same time, if those things never hurt them, is that still the person I love? So it is that, like, there's also just so much opportunity for angst, right? Yeah. They're getting to know each other all over again.
Love angst.
Exactly. Angst is my favorite thing to write.
I could tell. There's a lot of it. Yeah. In a good way. In a, you know.
Well, I love all angst. I think whenever characters are, like, you know, banging their head against the wall, I'm just giggling at my keyboard.
Is the businessman like, oh.
Yeah.
It's really.
Yeah.
All right.
The businessman is.
In the coffee shop.
They're all afraid of me. I'm a menace. coffee shop. Yeah. All to say, I love the trope.
Okay.
Yeah.
I loved it too. And you will also. Rosalind has also gone through a betrayal, much like Oliver and Phoebe and, and Orion, in that her mentor Daofeng, you know, was a double agent, triple agent sort of thing. So now she's sort of at a loss for this person who was very instrumental into her life. And, do you think it's important in young adult books to have adults that are disappointing? Oh, you like
great
that one?
Question. Yeah. Thanks. But it's, I almost feel like...
I'm going to do this more often.
I almost feel like most adults in young adult books are disappointing, though. Isn't that... There's a thing where it's like there are no parents in YA.
Sometimes, that's
They're
true.
Always yeah. dead.
Oh.
You know? Well, I really like writing...
All of them?
I feel like... Well, if you think about like most major YA series, they're either dead, absent, or useless.
Wow. Okay.
I feel like that sums up a lot of why.
Do they have flashback memories though of their parents?
Probably.
Or guardian.
Yeah. It's like, you know, in movies where it's like the dead wife trope.
Yes.
YA has dead parent trope.
Okay.
Yeah. I love it, by the way. That's not a critique. no, but I do like writing the parents in because I think so much of your teenage experience is reflecting off of what are you learning from like your home life and what your parents have shown you. So Rosalind gets, you know, a mentor figure that she saw as a father who then has abandoned her just as she knew would happen. And trying to say this without spoilers, sometimes things just aren't what you think they are. Sometimes there is, you know, the greater good for you. Sometimes people are still there for you, even if you can't see it entirely. Yeah, there were some scenes that I wrote with them and I was like, damn, that hurts me right here. Right in the meow meow.
Oh.
You guys know that meme? I quoted this meme on tour as well, and no one knew what I meant.
I don't know what it is.
You know the
I'm
cat?
Older, yes.
The cat, and there's it goes, a... that hurts me right in the meow meow, and the cat is patting its, like, heart. You guys
I
know
sure
the meme?
I sure don't, no.
Okay, Google that hurt right in the meow meow, and it'll pull up the image.
Everyone do it right now. Are you there? Can you show me later? Or,
okay. I'll show you later.
Oh, thanks, Chloe. That's nice.
Of course.
Okay,
of course.
Cool. Yeah. We have a rapport now. You've also been writing short stories, and I loved your horror story in The Gathering Dark.
Wow. I feel so seen right now. My short stories usually just
fly
off.
I did a lot of research, and I got that arc. It was really great. I did a panel with a bunch of the authors that were also in it. And I was hoping that you would explore more in the horror genre. Is that anything that you've decided upon, or are there other genres that you are expanding into that you are trying out?
I would love to do horror one day. I don't think I fully realized how much of a horror person I was until like three books in when people were like...
With all that stabbing and
I know, that's the thing. Right. I didn't understand. I didn't realize... Well, okay, first of all, the reason why I started thinking about it was because I kept getting anthology invites to horror anthologies. I was like, that's so funny. Why do they keep thinking of me? And then I go flipping through these Mountain Delights and it's like, and then her fingers clawed into her throat and pulled out 3 inches of gore and then blood gushed down her neck.
I mean, if that doesn't say rom-com, I don't know what does.
Yeah. So I would actually like to do horror proper one day. I do think I would need some really good storyline because I also think I'm a very like short story horror person where I just kill everyone and there's blood running and all of that. So, you know, I'm waiting for the day that...
So you'd write a slasher versus a...
Yeah. I have a slasher short story. I don't know if that's been announced. It's in Terry J. Benton's anthology. I think that is...
I think it's online.
Yes,
you
yes.
You can say it. It's not out yet
it's not
for a
out
while,
yet.
But...
Yeah, but it's... Yeah, that one is a slasher.
Okay.
I keep saying that I really want to do the cyberpunk genre.
Okay.
Ever since I read a paper in college where it was describing how the genre actually first started because American writers were really afraid of the rise of Japan in the 1980s, and a whole subgenre emerged from it because they equated a fallen future with an Asian future. And the moment I read that paper, it's called Techno-Orientalism by David Rowe, I was like, my God, I want to do that, but subvert it.
Yeah.
So
And you can see that a lot in the film Blade Runner.
Yes.
You can also, I
mean, in all cyberpunk movies, there is always like weird script in the background where it's like, that looks vaguely Asian, but like,
it's, but they can't figure
it out. It's not, yeah. You know, it's one of my favorite shows is Altered Carbon on Netflix.
I don't know it.
It's fantastic. Okay. I love it. However, the character is technically Asian and he's just in the body of like a white man the entire time.
Oh, gosh.
So, okay. You know, it's like, you know, I'd love to work with those ideas.
Okay.
Yeah.
As long as it's fun, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
We won't get it. It's a great show.
Okay. All right. moving on. Okay. You also, you know, I don't know when you sleep, but you made your adult debut this summer with Immortal Longings. The first part of the question is YA better? And the second is, I kid, but will you still please both write both of them?
Absolutely.
And how has that been writing an adult book?
Yes. Well, I love both YA and adult, and I think of them as having fundamentally different tones. Mm. So I am always, like, I don't imagine myself leaving YA anytime soon. I still have so many stories to tell in the YA voice. Mm-hmm. But the way I think about it is like, you know, in YA stories, there's always this air of where do I go next? What is the next thing I need to achieve this goal? And what is that ultimate kernel of hope that carries me through into my coming of age experience? Mm. And I think so much of adult is a lot messier. It's very undefined. It's, I have finished this coming of age experience and that kernel of hope has evaporated.
Yeah.
Which I kid a little, but I think of my YA characters as people who may do bad things and mess up, but at the end of the day, they are still teenagers and they have room for growth and you kind of want to wrap them up in a blanket and protect them from the world, no matter what they're going through. My adult characters sometimes are just bad people, you know? Okay. Their frontal lobes are developed. They have no excuse.
They're like, I don't have any remorse.
Yeah, well, they may have remorse, but if
I am accountable for all my mistakes.
Yes. Yeah. If they do make bad decisions at the point where you're like 25 years old, it's like, okay, well, then I'm kind of just reading you to follow this train wreck and see how entertaining it can get, as opposed to like, are you going to discover who you are? Mm. You know, you're an adult. You had your time to grow. You're just terrible.
You don't think people can evolve?
I think they can, but in a way that is not the coming of age experience.
Sure.
Yeah.
Be like, it's too late for that.
In a way. And then it's just, it's for entertainment, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can, I guess in adult books too, it's, I've never tried it because it looks really hard. But I think there's a lot more internal stuff that you can talk about, which you can do in YA too, but there's like more time to do it.
For sure.
Or YA pacing is kind of a lot faster than...
Adult just has more maneuvering room, I think. You have the opportunity to explore a lot of things where I kind of just think is irrelevant in YA. Because I imagine, like, who was I as a reader as a 16-year-old? Mm-hmm. There were certain topics and certain storylines that I was most interested in. And if they kind of diverted, I'd be like, I'm bored. I'm going to put this book down.
Wow.
Versus in an adult book, you do have
the
room.
I'm still bored, but I'm going to keep going.
Okay. Or you don't find it boring anymore.
Sure,
because
sure.
You are an adult and it has been written for adults.
You're like, mind. I also understand paying taxes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I still don't understand paying
taxes. Okay. You just get a guy.
Yeah.
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 James McGuire. Love him.
Oh.
He's like, so writing, huh? Oh, yeah. How many of you in the audience are writers? Like for fun or you enjoy it? You want to try it out? Okay. It's a good number. Chloe, do you have any advice? Because I know you started writing as a hobby when you were 13.
Mm-hmm. You did your research.
I sure did. This is no joke. And we wanted to make you feel very welcome. So thank you.
I do. You're welcome.
But so do you have any advice or when that happened where you're like, you know what? I really enjoy this. I want to pursue it professionally or not even professionally, but just like go to an open mic night or submit this to a college magazine or high school magazine, whatever that is. What advice would you give to the writers in the room?
I think the most valuable advice that I have heard is you need to be doing it for the right reasons in order to, I guess, stay sane and satisfied throughout the process. I think a lot of times people will hold up these goalposts in their heads where, once I get published, I'm going to feel like a real writer. Once I see my book's hair, I'm going to feel like a real writer. Or like, once I'm a bestseller, once I get this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you first and foremost just have to be content with the idea that getting published means nothing more than sharing your stories with people. Because if you try to ride your idea of like, this is what makes me an author on like concrete ideals, it is going to drive you nuts. Publishing is a wild
journey.
It's a wild, wild space, yeah. Right? Nothing is guaranteed. It is a lot of like hard work mixed in with luck, first and foremost. And, you know, when you decide to put your books out there, I think you have to make that peace with, I want to be an author because I want people to read my books. And if I can get that connection one-on-one, each one of that is as important as anything else. You know, if you have concrete goals, you can have concrete goals, but you cannot make your own like self-esteem as an author like, you know, contingent on that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good to, I guess, get to the essence of why you do it.
Yes.
I think there's a lot of distraction and there's a lot of things like, wouldn't that be cool? And it's great to dream.
It is.
But
and they are cool most
times. Yeah. But I think also the story has to be first, right?
Absolutely.
So you love your characters, you plot it out, you know where you want them to go. And you spend time with these people. Like if you start a story, and yours are long, by the way.
Yeah.
This is 545 pages.
Yeah.
I know, because I read all of it.
Yeah.
Which was great, but you know, went by fast, but you know. You have to spend a lot of time on a thing, on a story, and it changes, and there are things you cut, and there are people that you cut. Like I had a grandfather character that didn't make a final book, and I had drafts with him in it. I'm like, R.I.P. grandfather.
Yeah.
But, you know, he wasn't serving the story.
Exactly.
So it's a lot of keeping at it, too. I think that's really important.
Sure.
What are you working on now? Can you tell us?
I'm working on the sequel to Immortal Longings.
Okay. That's the adult book.
That's the adult book. It is killing me.
How so?
Well,
like Roberta Flack killing you softly, or like Friday the 13th, Jason?
Friday the 13th.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Well, I'm rewriting it from scratch, which I swore I would never do after I rewrote Foul Lady Fortune from scratch twice. But as is the case with most manuscripts, books do not listen to you, you listen to them.
Yeah.
So, you know, I finished that first draft, and then the first draft grabbed me by the throat and said, redo me, so now I'm redoing. Yeah.
When does that happen for you? Because for me, it's like I start out with a character's voice, but then everyone you sort of introduce, like they speak louder, and you have to make sure the main character is the focus, I guess. But when does that happen for you when you're...
For me, I have to finish a first draft before I see the problem areas with it. Mm-hmm. I used to have a big habit of going back and editing as I went, but I found that it didn't serve me. Because if no matter how much I polished up that prose, I could get to the end and I could realize that whole subplot needs to go, actually.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't matter how well I word it. It has to go nonetheless. So I need to finish a whole first draft.
Okay.
And only when I've reached the end, because I'm so character forward,
yes,
that by the time I get to the end, I'm like, oh, now I understand what your learning journey the entire time was. And by the time I've got to the end, I'm like, okay, we need to take a different set of steps to get you here. And then I realize what edits I'm going to make.
Mm.
Yeah, it's rough.
Is there ever a character that you know, when you end a series, when you end a book, you're like, okay, they're on the shelf. But is there ever one that you sort of want to take elements of and bring them into a newer story? Like, not, it's a different character, but they're taking a lot of the essence.
Yeah. I kind of did that intentionally with These Violent Delights and Immortal Longings, which was very English major of me because, you know, I read a paper once comparing Romeo and Juliet to Antony and Cleopatra, saying that these two star-crossed lovers are effectively the same archetype, but they feel so different because Romeo and Juliet are children who are reacting to external circumstances versus Antony and Cleopatra are adults who their whole star-crossed shtick going on is completely their own fault. And I really wanted to kind of mimic that with my YA debut and my adult debut. So when I was writing Calla, there's a lot of Juliet in her as a fundamental archetype. But then when you really sit down with the two of them, you can understand that Juliet is a product of her nature, and you remove her from that and she would be someone different. Mm. But Kella is just rotten to the core. And I love that. I love writing. I love getting to write female main characters like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like a villainelle.
Yeah. Or at least someone who, like, you can understand they're about to descent into some kind of power corruption, but we're only at book one.
All is not well. Yeah.
All is soon to be in flames.
That's pretty good. I don't know. Where can people find you on social media? Oh. Have you heard of social media?
Not at all.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I live in a cave.
I got a TikTok last year because I was like, well, I'd like young people to read my stuff, you know? So, and then I made one and was like, nope. So I think it's not for me. But for people who do use social media, how do you think are healthy ways to connect? And what are good boundaries for people to have?
I mean, I always think always post what you want to post. Mm. Like, don't ever force yourself to, like, follow trends or, like, you know, share things that you're not comfortable with, because people can tell if you're having the most terrible time on social media, especially when, like, TikTok was starting to burst up and everyone in publishing was like, authors, get on TikTok, like, sell your books.
Rather than be like, here's a marketing budget for that we're responsible for. That'd be great.
Yeah. But, you know, you know, I think you can always tell if someone is having the worst time online. So just
be yourself.
Know, have fun.
Yes. And don't take it too serious, which is hard because I think, too, in COVID, like, there was a lot of being online, right?
So, well, speaking of social media, can we post for my Be
Real?
Yes,
that's right. Chloe has a Be Real.
I missed it. I was late.
Oh,
so
I'm sorry.
No. I was late up in the
green
room.
Do you consent to Chloe's Be Real? If you don't, you can
hide your face if you don't consent. We're going to take our side
What first. Happens? We just take
a
photo?
Yeah. Okay, it's us first.
I'm a geriatric millennial.
Okay, it's us
Here
first.
I am. Okay. I'm being real. The realest I've ever been.
Okay, now it's you guys.
Here we go.
Excellent. Okay, beautiful. I can barely see you guys because of the lights, but let me see how it looked.
Okay.
I think I got everyone.
Do you want to do it again?
I can't do it again. Be real is mean. Yeah. Oh. All of you are like 3 pixels. You're just you're Slender Man.
Wow. Okay.
But I'll post it. Don't worry. You'll
That's
get
exciting.
To,
we have an electronic souvenir. Right? For the memes?
For the memes.
Is that what people say?
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Got it. You got it.
Oh, man. The times, they are changing. Okay. I think we should start Q&A. How do you feel about it?
I feel great.
Okay. So if you could please genteelly line up behind that microphone.
Run for it.
Don't run. And again, if there is a person that is of the younger variety, please let them go to the front.
Not that fight each other if you have to.
And I will cut you off or say when the last person is to go. And as you line up, let's get to the first question. Yes, please introduce yourself and hello.
Hi, Chloe. I'm Bella. Thank you so much for coming here. I'm a huge fan. I just wanted to ask you, because I just got to college, how did you balance writing and college?
Mm-hmm. Well, be prepared to lose a lot of sleep. That's my realistic take. But it is very doable. It is just, I think prioritization is the number one thing. A lot of people will kind of say, like, you know, college has so much going on. Like, where would you even fit writing in? And the answer to that is, think of writing almost as another class you're taking. Because then you kind of put value into it, and it forces yourself to treat it equally important, like, to a class, right? There's no end to readings in college. There's no end to assignments. At any point in time, there is something you could be doing. So sometimes it's really hard to justify sitting down with your manuscript that's like not due to a professor, right? But you have to build that time in, because otherwise it doesn't get written. So give yourself, like, you know, an hour, a few minutes every single day to draft, or if you are the type of person, like one afternoon per week, things like that. But build the time in, and, you know, at the same time, give yourself, like, you know, the space to rest as well, because college is very hectic. Good luck.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Hi, Chloe. My name is Grace, and I was wondering if you ever felt, like, the pressure to write contemporary fiction instead of historical fiction because of the lack of, like, historical knowledge regarding Chinese history.
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I think the lack of historical, like, anything China inspired was what actually pushed me to do historical, right? Because I was so interested in this time period that I had never seen done before for my exact tastes. There is 1920s Shanghai books about, like, a British expat prancing around, or there's 1920s Shanghai media for Chinese-speaking audiences, but there was never anything right in between for, like, the local perspective with English text. So, you know, I wanted to fill in that little niche. I wanted to add a little story in, and ever since I published These Mild Delights, there have been, I think, three other 1920s Shanghai, like, fantasy novels being published, and I love that. It means we actually have the room to be, like, varied and have different voices rather than one person speaking for all of us. So I highly encourage people to kind of write their exact niches instead of following what other people are doing.
Great question.
Hi, Chloe. My name is Sophia, and my question is, you write a lot about a lot of different places, mm-hmm. from, like, the city to mm-hmm. the countryside and different houses. Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite place to write about?
Oh, to write about or a favorite place to write in?
No, to write about.
To write about.
Where your characters
are. I mean, I love city settings. I think you can tell when you read my books because I will spend, like, three paragraphs describing a building. And that's, like, what I don't cut away because my editor is like, please, enough with the building. I really love cityscapes. There's just so much life in it that you really do not see when it's less dense. You know, there's stories all the time. I think right now, 1920s Shanghai has been, like, my favorite place to work in. It's endless in story.
Thank you.
Hi, Chloe. Oh, my name is Karen. As, like, an older sibling, what's mm-hmm. something that, like, your younger siblings, like, would not understand from an older sibling perspective, because I'm the youngest. Mm-hmm.
Oh, great question.
Like, especially in, like, a Asian
younger siblings never understand the sacrifices we put in for you guys. My God, I remember when I was my sister's age, I was not allowed to have any snacks before dinner. Like, those were off limits because I would ruin my appetite. Oh. And now my sister eats anything she wants because we fought the battle.
We're the test run.
Yeah.
You understand?
Yeah.
And then when you come along, it's like, oh.
Yeah. Okay. We're the curfews. Yeah. We're the tight rules. We're the, like, you know,
de facto
settings.
Parent. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, give your older sibling some love.
And also the older sibling loves you very much.
Yeah.
But stay out of their room, or
don't stand in the entryway of their room being like, I'm not in your room. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Chloe. I'm Lucy. And my question is about, first specifically about Immortal Longings. Mm-hmm. Did you go into writing it already knowing, I'll call it the reveal, mm-hmm. and then do you go into writing, you say you plan, like, do you know your endings right at the beginning of mm-hmm. the writing process, or is it sort of something you figure out uh-huh. and changes a lot?
Fantastic question.
You guys, bangers only with these questions.
Yeah, really fantastic good. Question. Yes, I did go into Immortal Longings knowing the reveal, because the reveal is, like, the fundamental core of Immortal Longings. Like, on first glance, it is one of those classic fantasy royalty revolution stories, right? Someone is trying to replace a throne. Someone is trying to claim that they will be the better king. But fundamentally, what the Flesh and False Gods trilogy is arguing is that there is no good king under a bad system. It's impossible. And so much of book one is focusing on that swap-in. And then when you find the reveal, you realize, okay, I understand the motive behind that. And then you also see, okay, I see where this descent is going. It's a tragedy trilogy, you know? Like, there are, people's hubris is going to get the best of them. There's going to be that sense of, like, what is that word? Hamartia, right? Like, it's ultimately the thing that is your downfall is that thing you thought was your strength. I'm trying to be so coy for people who haven't read Immortal Longings. But I will always go into a story knowing the ending first. Maybe not the exact sequence of events that happens, but I have to know, what is that feeling we are ending on? What is that tone that we're trying to invoke? And ultimately, what is that character walking away with? Are they learning something? Are they losing something? Are they winning something? Things like that. I don't need to know exactly what it is, but I have to know what I'm running towards.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello.
My name is Tomi, and I'm curious because a lot of your work is inspired by like older literature, mm-hmm. older pieces of history, Romeo and Juliet, mm-hmm. Antony and Cleopatra. And I'm curious, what about it is, what about retellings calls mm-hmm. to you?
Oh, great question.
Bangers only.
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think the value of retellings is that it has one foot in the past and one foot in the present. I originally had chosen to do a Romeo and Juliet retelling because I had the plot line of These Violent Delights. It was two rival families in a gang war who hate each other for a reason unbeknownst to the children who are falling in love. And I looked at that and I said, no one is going to listen to this elevator pitch and not go, oh, so you're rewriting Romeo and Juliet, right? And so I thought, why don't I just fully embrace those similarities instead of trying to flinch away from them? There's nothing really in English literature anymore that is wholly unique. We're always playing off of ideas that are still in existence. And to do a retelling kind of means, let me take an idea I know is, you know, very familiar to people, but I'm going to put a new lens over it. And if I put a new lens over it, what new things are popping out of old ideas and what value can I find in that? So, of course, Romeo and Juliet is about love in the strength of, like, well, love and hope up against a cycle of hatred and how that is ultimately the strongest move to make. And then when you transplant it into 1920s Shanghai, it's not just about two equal families anymore in the way that Romeo and Juliet is so, like, two houses, both alike in dignity, right? Put it in 1920s Shanghai, suddenly there are imperial Western forces. And it also explores hatred when it is between, like, uneven groups, when one group has more power over the other, and then there are two groups who are equally, you know, hating each other. Like, what does it mean to team up against another force? What does it mean to be up against them? There are just so many more questions up against an existing framework, and I love that.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Malia. My question is, how do you thoroughly world build without including too much or too little detail?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I could sit here for 40 minutes just
how to not get bogged down in exposition and
I mean, I think the thing about world building is that it always has to be relevant to your story. So much of, I think, our impulse is to add in details to make that world feel real. But then think about how you go around your world as an everyday, like, existing person, I guess, right? You notice things if it is relevant to you. You notice things when it catches your attention or if it has some sort of impact on your day. And then it says something about you depending on what you're noticing, how you're thinking about it. So you can think about world building for a fictional character in the exact same way. Things that they notice will say something about their personality or about the story they're about to encounter or about the next observation you're about to, you know, meet them with. So anything that you can justify as, like, relevant to the story is justifiable world building. And you know what? Writing is rewriting. You can just world dump all you want and then go back and edit it. Don't be afraid of it.
Thank you.
Hi, Chloe. My name's Mercy. I love the historical settings of your novels, but I also love the fantastical, almost fabulous elements you add to them. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering what inspired you to not do a telling, so historical fiction, but also add that fantasy and how it may have complicated your writing process.
Oh. That is a really good question. You guys are like
Boston,
really
man.
Thinking of them.
We bring it. We read a lot.
Big brains.
A lot of universities, a lot of high schools. I'm so proud of all of you. I don't know you, and that's not meant to be condescending. So anyway, the question.
Anyway, All of my, anytime I'm inserting speculative elements, I really wanted to say something about the quieter parts of the story. I kind of accidentally stumbled onto that in These Violent Delights because I was thinking about it from a logical front first. I had that base plot line, And I started with the understanding that neither of the two gangs were the villains. You know, there were the Scarlet, there's the Scarlet Gang, the White Flowers, but they're on equal standing. They're not actually actively, like, one is not the bad guy, so to speak, and most stories need a bad guy. And I was like, okay, the bad guy is colonialism. Yes, that's true, but, like, how do you really visualize that?
It has a monocle and a mustache. And
Yeah. But I was kind of like, it is very hard to put that on a page in a sudden way to move a story along. And so I was kind of like, you know what? I'm just going to throw a monster in there and see what happens. And I finished that first draft, and I stepped back, and I went, oh, damn, the monster's a metaphor for colonialism. That's wild. That was big-brained of me. And then I went back and revised it and made it logical, wherein, you know, the consequences of these colonial forces have caused this monster, the spread, and the false blame is in some way commentating on the politics of this time. And from that moment forward, I kind of understood the way that I wanted to interweave any speculative elements with historical. In Foul Lady Fortune, it is the invention of, like, super soldier serums and brainwashing, and this is a time of, like, imperialism from the Japanese Empire where you can accept certain things that they're offering you, but then you lose your free will. So I always think, what does a fantastical element comment on? How does it improve what I am saying about the history? And how does it make all of these genres, like, blend together rather than feel side by side in a clunky way?
Thank you very much.
Of course. Great question.
Hello, my name's Kaylin, and I was wondering if, especially for being a young writer, what would you say would be the best first step for publishing and writing?
Oh, great question. I mean, the most important first step is have that finished manuscript. Nothing else matters, I promise. Publishing a book is about that manuscript. A lot of people now are saying, like, oh, I need a social media following. Like, I need to know people. I need to go to festivals. I had none of
that.
They
still let me publish.
Well, I was a random teenager from, like, suburban Auckland. Like, I literally had nothing to do with the industry whatsoever. Mm. All I had was a finished manuscript, and I cold emailed agents, you know, with a query letter about that manuscript. And that is truly all you need to get your foot in the door. So before you start worrying about anything else, make that story the best it could possibly be on your own terms. It doesn't have to be perfect. You know, you're still going to edit with an agent. You're still going to edit with an editor. You're still going to edit and edit and edit so many drafts before it gets published. But as far as that product you are sending out into the world, just make sure it's something you're proud of, and that's all you really need.
Also, in the books you like, or if there's an author whose story is similar to yours, you can always look in the acknowledgments of the book, like the acknowledgments of Chloe's book. I'm sure you thanked your agent.
I love my agent.
You look at these agents that are in all the acknowledgments of all these books. Mm. You Google them, see what they're open to, if they're open for queries, meaning they're taking, you know, letters, and that you write a very nice letter that's nice and tight, and you have the polished manuscript. And also look at what they want, right? Mm. So they'll say, I'm interested in sci-fi, I'm not interested in rom-com, or whatever you're writing. So that's helpful, too.
And for anyone who needs a TLDR on what a query letter is, I have it on my website, so you can
Which
is thechloegong.com. Yeah, chloegong.com was taken.
What do you think they do there?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
The Chloe Gong Twitter profile is, well, like, Chloe Gong, like, at Chloe Gong on Twitter is just, like, a blank profile. So I don't know. I don't know what they're doing out there.
They're missing out.
Yeah.
Wow. There's only one. I mean, there's more, but you're the Chloe Gong.
I'm the Chloe Gong now.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We have time for one last question. I'm sorry, but make it a good one.
Yeah, last one. My name's Eliza, and I was wondering, have you ever considered writing a retelling of something other than Shakespeare? Mm-hmm. And if so, what would that be, and, like, how would you retell it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, great question. Fun fact, Foul Lady Fortune was originally going to be a retelling of The Mourning Bride by William Congreve. That is the play where the line, "Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned," actually comes from, that everyone misattributes to Shakespeare. So I was going to do something funky, being like, oh, look, I did a Shakespeare retelling for my first duology, and now I'm doing like a retelling of a play that is very well known for being misattributed. And then I pivoted, because I was like, actually, I don't really like this play. It's kind of boring. That was when I started looking at Shakespeare's other plays. I started seeing that As You Like It had a protagonist named Rosalind, and that the themes were really resonant for what I wanted to work for the story, and I pivoted gears and did an As You Like It retelling. So the beauty of a retelling is that I really just need to be obsessed with what it's trying to say, because only then can I re-say it, right? So maybe in the future I'll find like something that I really want to work with, but as of right now, not sure yet. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So what we're going to do before, great questions, everybody. We're going to take our seats, stay in our seats. Before we give a Boston thank you so much, farewell, you're the greatest, applause for Chloe and thank her, we're going to make sure after we do all that, we stay in our seats until Chloe gets situated. And then when she gets situated, someone will be like, it's okay now. And then you can buy your books or line up for Chloe to sign. She's gracious enough to do it. And so we are so appreciative. So stay in your seats until Chloe is situated. Got it? Cool. Thank you so much for being a great crowd. You were so awesome. Chloe,
we
want to thank you
joke.
So much.
That
was really good. Wow.
Oh, my God.
Done. It's great.
I love it.
And Chloe, thank you for writing, and we look forward to more books from you. And you are vivacious
and charming,
witty,
wow.
And absorbing.
Thank
yeah.
you. I'm blushing.
So the copy was not wrong. So we are going to walk Chloe. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me grab my bag with
yes.
the Sharpies.
Go get your bag with the Sharpies.
Can
We're all staying in our chair. Yes. Yeah.
Can you hold those signs up again, the I
yes.
Heart Elisa ones? I'd like to take a picture of that. Thank you. I love it. Thank you.
And you guys can talk. It's okay.
Yeah.
Just stay in your seats. And we're going to wait till Chloe makes it up front.
Okay. Don't all
and
watch
I'm,
me.
I'm going to go with you, too.
Stop.
And you can clap for her if you want.
Woo!
You can, yeah, we
wow!
did it.
Oh, my God.